I'm delighted to welcome George Bowman, Zen Master Bowman, to the Boundless Way Temple. George has been my teacher for over 20 years now, and now a great friend and colleague to both Melissa and I. George is also one of the honorary founders of the Boundless Way Temple, which actually means he didn't do squat, but has been cheering from the sidelines from the very beginning, and often saying, "Better you than me." But this does mean that he has first dibs on the little cabin in the back corner of the property as a retirement house. But behind him there is a waiting line. So. But George, thank you so much. Yeah. Great to have you here.
Well, I'm not going to get a gold watch for all these decades, but I have quite a palatial place waiting for me. Yeah. My dotage. a deep pleasure to sit in the sandwich here. I'm in the sandwich between, and to be in the sandwich, we find ourselves in lots of sandwiches, I'm sure, some more claustrophobic and less pleasant than others, but this sandwich is a wonderful sandwich for me, because I'm in between two of the people I love and respect most in my life. So that's a pretty great thing. Of course, the filling in the sandwich varies depending on the time of day. Earlier today, I was feeling like a bologna sandwich with very bad yellow mustard on it. And other times, a more nutritious filling. But it does, for all of us, I think, shapeshift and morph throughout the day. What is where we are and what we are, and we are encouraged and dedicated each in our own way to inhabit and to participate, partake of that nutrition, whatever it may be, and sometimes it's a wonderful meal, and other times it's a meal that is more challenging to swallow or to be with, or even entertain the possibility that there might be anything nutritious at all about it. But that is our vow as bodhisattvas. And we are all, as Rinzai says, worthy practitioners of the Buddha Dharma, worthy lovers of this one endless dimension, universal life. That both is the source of great fulfillment and love, and also snatches everything away from us and breaks our heart and takes it all away, and then restores itself, and it goes on. And as practitioners, as bodhisattvas, our vow is to partake of it all, partake of the meal. No small matter, especially events of the day. For me, in this moment, I feel like someone very large is sitting on my chest. A very heavy man or something is sitting on my chest. Great weight on my chest, and the weight on my chest, I'm sure you have felt this off and on as well with the events of what's going on in our community. It's quite a weight, and at times it feels quite suffocating and quite oppressive, as though I can hardly breathe. And then, as I go into it more deeply, of course, there's a great suffocating sadness and grief that is underneath this constriction or difficulty breathing or feeling. Not even knowing what I'm feeling, except that I'm feeling like this weight is upon me. So I'm sure we all go in and out of this, each one of us in our own way. And underneath it, of course, there is a great sadness and a great fearfulness and a edge of anger and all kinds of deep movements of feeling. Actually, as I speak about it and I allow myself to feel it or to take refuge in the truth of my experience, I feel some movement and some air and ability to start to breathe again, and I feel in being able to just experience this whole mixture of sadness and grief and also love of being with good friends, doing what I most want to do. It's a mixture of both, actually. This being in the Zendo is where I feel most at home. Not that it's always easy to be in the Zendo, or that we encounter things that are easy to be with, but that I, over the years now, since starting doing this in the 60s, in the late 60s, I've always had a great appetite for Zazen practice, and so in the Zendo I feel a certain sense of being at home, and that whatever comes down the line, I can meet it here. I don't feel that way in all other areas of my life. I'm sure you don't as well, but I do feel incredibly grateful that there is a place or a seat in which I am willing to, you know, give it my best shot to be with it. So here we are, and we all are practitioners of the way, and as practitioners of the way, our vow, our intention, however skillfully we can embody it or engage it or personalize it, is to participate or partake of the meal, to be with the truth or the aliveness of the moment as the enlightened way. It's a very radical teaching, that what we're looking for is to be found in this moment, and that it is to be found in this moment, and it is not conditional upon whether the moment be a happy, joyous, fulfilling moment, or whether the moment be one of loss or sadness or grief. That's a wild and a radical teaching, but it is this beautiful, fierce a practice of Zen in the Bodhisattva way, to sit upright in the center of the aliveness of the moment as the way of a Bodhisattva. And the teaching is, and we all have testified to it to some degree or other, or we wouldn't be here, and we all have known the intimate truth of this. And when we talk about truth in the Zen tradition, we don't mean true as opposed to false, or true because I think so, or the consensus of the tribe tells me that it's probably true. And we don't mean true or faith in a belief, but we mean true because it's truly so. And when something is truly so, and there isn't anything other than the suchness or the immediacy of that truthfulness, we call that the Dharma, or suchness, or that the Tathagata, that which appears exactly and precisely just like this, and then disappears like this, steps aside and makes room for another. So that is our commitment, our study, our self-study, and then to engage and to be with it, or to sit upright in it. And quite a thing, isn't it? Quite a thing to head down this road. My teacher, Daesan Sanim, who I had the good sometimes it felt like good fortune, and other times it didn't feel like such good fortune, but that's the nature of committed relationships. We go through our 10,000 joys and sorrows with that person who we have touched and been touched by in some way, and have made a vow to ourselves to enact that encounter that was true. Certainly those of us who have fallen in love and gotten married, and of course that may be metaphor for all kinds of intimacies or encounters, but that we touch to something with a so-called other, and that encounter, that seeing and being seen, or that touching and being touched by, and the synapse that takes place when life meets itself in this kind of unfabricated, immediate way, the synapse, the brightness of that encounter, which we call the Dharmakaya body, so impacts us, and so inspires us that we, I think it's fair to say that we, on a deep level, not just on a personal infatuation, but that something a deeper, perhaps, and more significant than just a personal likes and dislikes or the biology of youth with its imperatives to recreate itself and so forth. But we touch and are touched by something that so impacts us and is so true and so immediate that it becomes a compass setting or a compass point for our life. And then we set off. Of course, we lose sight with that aliveness or that kensho or that contact with essential nature. But it remains in our blood and bones. It's stored in some a deep place and is accessible. It becomes clearly accessible to us, certainly in our Zazen practice, if we go deep and we are committed to really being with what's going on. And then, of course, we might commit our lives to being with that person. Or in the case of Sansanim, I had so many powerful, important experiences for myself as a young man that I thought, well, I'm signing on, and I'm gonna go with this. So had the like in any committed relationship, it's no walk in the park, but off you go, and you grow in love and understanding by enacting your love as best you can, and your commitment as best you can, and hopefully grow. And so I had good fortune to have this happen, and then to spend so many years, 20 years, traveling, living with him and traveling the world with this guy, going through all kinds of experiences. He said, we get lots of teachings from the people who are important to us as mentors. Some bounce off our carapace and don't lodge. Others, in some mysterious way, it's really more an act of grace. It's not due to some kind of skillful means we have about trying to be open or be sensitive or empathic. It's much deeper than that. But some words or phrases or teachings encounters find their way through our carapace and through our armor and lodge deep in the heartland. And they move us or touch us in some way. We call this in the Zen tradition turning words. Words that are that touch us in some deep place and direct us or guide us or inspire us, or at the very least have some shelf life for us. Maybe we read a passage from Dogen and we hear a word and it flirts with us and it catches our eye, you know, it flirts with us and we have a certain shelf life. There's something about that word. Certainly when I read these teachings, there are phrases or words that pop up or come alive. So Sansanim, one of the things that he encouraged me to do early on was to, in talking about Dharma or sharing with friends or talking about Dharma, to really trust my innate responsiveness that the moment will call me forward, and that the less I have around that, the better off I'll be. So in the early days, he would have me give talks, which for a terminally introverted person such as myself were traumatic experiences. But he would say, do not, he said, your Zazen and your study over the course of your years of practice together with friends is you have been digesting it in your life. So when it's time to speak, I want you to press C and jump off the high board with no preparation whatsoever. And whenever you speak, I want you to do this. And I want you to look me in the eye and tell me you commit yourself to this now. Whew. So I said, okay, so here I am. I try not to prepare, as I'm sure we all do when we have to talk. And actually, when you're talking with people that you spend a lot of time with, there's a certain grace or a certain predictability or a certain ease, and you can kind of jabber along, and the stakes aren't quite so high. But when you come to a new place, or you know, I'm sure that those of you who give talks or talk as metaphor where you're sitting between old friends who you actually love and respect, and the ante goes up a little bit, but it's that same place of imperative. And it's interesting because in reflecting on countless Dharma talks that I have given or presentations we all make in our life, it doesn't have to be a talk, it could be anything at all that we're invested in and we care about, there is a certain mental rehearsal that goes on behind the scenes, like, oh, you can, why don't you, oh, I've got it, you can talk about the aliveness, or you can, oh, that's really great, tell a story about it. And it sort of seems quite exciting and plausible at the time, but then if I hold on to it and keep it, you know, like a dog chewing on an old bone or something, when it comes time, it has no vitality whatsoever. It doesn't work. So, and seems to lead me down the place of the critic and the backseat driver that says, oh, you know, that's really not. So we press C and we jump. Jump off the 100-foot pole, or jump into the unknown, and trust that our minds are innately responsive and able to manifest something when called upon. And I think that's quite a terrifying and wonderful thing. So what comes up to me as I'm... two things occur right in this moment. One is responsiveness. James is talking about, and we all, everybody, each in our own way, has, I'm sure, been reflecting on this and thinking about it, and the Dharma talks have been around this capacity to respond to situations in some kind of immediate, uncontrived way. I was really touched by, I think it was Corey talking about, I can't even remember what it was, except that I grew up in the south side of Chicago, and was a bit of a street kid in a certain, in a protected way, but I what he said really touched me. And one of the things that touched me was this capacity that we have as human beings to, that life has the capacity to respond to itself in these wonderful creative ways. I mean, sometimes they're quite traumatic in the sense that the events of this dreadful bombing and the heroism of people without thinking or without premeditation just responding and running to the aid of people and just doing it, not trying to be a hero, not even considering heroism at all, but just responding. But also in wonderful small ways, this Buddha nature that we have, this innate wakefulness, this innate intelligence and capacity to know and appreciate, or know and love, has this wonderful capacity to respond to whatever it meets. And it has this capacity to respond in creative and truly alive and gratifying and generative ways. So many examples. So many wonderful, even small examples in our life of perhaps a moment at a checkout counter in the grocery store, and eyes meet with the person who's checking you out, and a flicker of recognition of life seeing itself, and the immediacy of that recognition that is not dependent upon words or letters. It is clearly a direct transmission of mind, where life meets itself and even in a small, almost unnoticeable way, recognizes itself and smiles and nods quietly to itself and goes on about its business, having been to some degree refreshed and restored by something that is completely, in a sense, modest, almost invisible, but absolutely true, and so true that often we don't even notice. We don't even notice it. But a teaching of the Zen tradition is that this Dharmakaya body, this body which is our own essential nature, is one of pure possibility, pure intelligent possibility, and that it has its innate capacity is a responsive one. It can reflect what comes in front of it immediately. And when that reflection is clear, or uncontrived or unfabricated, we say in Zen. Our job as bodhisattvas is to cut the gap between ourselves and the aliveness of this moment, or truth of this moment, as our intention to meet or participate in this, and in trust that in a completely unfabricated way, and not that we're always, you know, pruning and grafting and cutting deals and all the stuff of human life, which we all endlessly do, thinking that we know better than the Buddha, or that we know better than God. If I can use the G word, people get Buddhists get uncomfortable when we use the G word. But I myself am actually quite fond of the G word. And when people challenge me, "You mean you believe in God? You're a Buddhist, you're a Zen Buddhist," I say, "Yes, most assuredly I believe in God. I believe in a God that has no fixed position whatsoever." So I think about this wonderful Dharmakaya, a body that has no fixated position, that simply responds, the great round mirror has no likes or dislikes, it responds immediately to whatever it is that comes before it. Reflects and knows whatever it is that comes before it. So we throw shit in the Charles River, or we throw shit in the river, and the river becomes a shit river. Immediately it becomes a shit river. And this, we have this wonderful capacity, this wonderful Buddha nature to know and appreciate what it, we have this capacity to know and appreciate life in the form of. Now, initially, the appreciation and that capacity, that wonderful, bright, illuminating capacity, this capacity to for this potential to meet its particular expression and to find satisfaction or love, we call that the Sambhogakaya body, the body of intimacy or the body of bliss, the body of kensho, to perceive, to know or to perceive the nature, to perceive the immediacy, or to know the immediacy, or the pure possibility in the form of, not as an object, not as an object, but as ourselves. That's, we say, a kensho. Ken meaning to perceive, but not perceive something as an object, but to know. Know in the sense that there's no need to think about it. Know in the sense that there's no need to even raise a thought about it, because it's just that way. And when it's just that way, there's no grafting or pruning or adding or taking away, and there's no doubt, and there's no reason, and there's no time. And there is no time. And in that no meaning and no time, there is the great meaning. Or maybe just a little bit of Never quite saw it that way before when somebody shares something, but that capacity that Sansanim was encouraging me to have greater faith in is quite a thing, isn't it? Quite a thing. This wonderful, bright, completely ungraspable and unknowable self-nature, center of gravity that we all are. This brightness is not to be confused with the spaciousness of a laya consciousness, not to denigrate that kind of quietism or spaciousness that we all take refuge in and relax in and float in. And what a wonderful thing it is to have ease of well-being and to float in that great sea. But hidden beneath and embodied within that quietness is a brightness and an intelligence that is both serene, unfabricated, completely unperturbable, and totally dynamic. That's the teaching of what we are. And we all touch this, and we all know this. So, and we see it under certain circumstances, and this response is so immediate. You sit in the quiet of the Zendo, and hopefully all of us can enjoy a deep absorption, at least at times. And hopefully with practice that absorption can be deeper than an absorption, but a boundless samadhi. a great unimpeded, we say, formless field of benefaction. Purpose is not to dwell there, but it is a very, very ripe condition to have no thought. And it is possible for us as human beings to experience the mind which is free of thought for periods of no time. And when we encounter something in that completely innocent and uncontrived way, the sound of the bird outside in the early morning, that sound of the bird issues forth from the very center of our heart of hearts. And we know why the bird sings. And we need no explanation why the bird sings his heart out in this brilliant, brilliant, bright, lilting voice. It illuminates our wonderful self-nature, illuminates as the sound of the bird. And we all are touched to one degree or another by the immediacy and truthfulness of this experience. And if we wanted to give voice to it or put it in Zen language, we might say, how do you realize one true nature while listening to the sound of a bird? How do you manifest true love when listening to the sound of the bird? And it's so obvious and so straightforward for timeless moments, isn't it? And it's true because there isn't anything else, you see. So we say that a potential or that formless field can know itself in the form of what? And we call that experience kensho, to perceive the nature. Kensho is the foundation of Zen practice, realization, self-realization, self-realizing itself in the form of. And it is the foundation of Zen practice and an absolute necessity for all of us to experience this clearly and without doubt and reservation. Not that we can keep it, of course not. It self-destructs. There is no fixed position. The activity of Dharma doesn't tarry for a moment, and our deep, wonderful realizations or our modest little ahas or whatever they are do not fixate themselves, and they become our problem and our difficulty, and then we got to deal with that, and our realization becomes our delusion, and so it goes. But there was a moment, and the moment was very clear, and the process is completely lucid, and that's our bodhisattva way. To perceive the nature not as an object, but to perceive this one nature as manifesting in this form. So, and in that there is synapse and gnosis, we know. And we don't need to understand anything. That's a, now, that being said, of course there are other more difficult experiences, aren't there, that we are called upon to bear more than witness to, but to partake of in the meal and participate in. I run out of time, but I wanted to mention a dear old friend. So many friends now, as we grow long in tooth, younger to our death, are dear friends along, good friends along the way. As a reggae song goes, good friends we've lost along the way. One of them for me was Achan Mahagosananda, a Cambodian monk who appeared at the New York Zen Center when I was there one winter day in his robes, fresh from the killing fields of Cambodia, bearing witness to family and friends, millions of family and friends, brutally slaughtered. So here was this being who appeared. His robes were packed with newspapers, and his practice was metta, not in a dopey way, but in a very a profound way. And of course, some of you may know him. He used to give Dharma talks to large groups of people. He'd conjugate in French the verb to be, or sometimes he'd do it in English, I am. But he had this wonderful halting English, this I am, you are, he, she, or it is, we are, you are, they are, and then he'd smile. And then he had a tape recorder of that. And he put on the tape recorder and he'd listen to it play and smile until everybody got bored and left. uh, I was quite fond of Achen, a wonderful, wonderful teacher. So I am and inspired by him, because he wasn't a dope, you know. He wasn't a person who dwelled in, but he went forward and responded to the call and went to the camps and the killing fields and carried on in some way. It's inconceivable to me, but anyway, so here we are. And we, since we all know the process and the way, and we've all tasted it, and we all are called upon to personalize more of it in our experience, and to trust this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful capacity that we have, and to support each other in the work. What a blessing for me to come here and feel everyone's effort. And each person in their own wonderful, idiosyncratic, kind of wacky, wonderful, loving, eccentric way, doing their best to be present and manifesting their love. And that love and determination informs me. And I quietly say, oh, thank you, never quite thought of it in that way before. Or, oh, I might have been this way before. And then there's also the whole mix of it together in this room of everyone working. And we support each other and encourage each other. And when I am on my knees on broken glass, maybe David's feeling quite buoyant. And then other times I'm feeling, had my morning coffee and having quite a commendable, wonderful time. And someone else, and so we go. So my appreciation and deep respect for you all of us in this process, and encouragement for us to march forward in the work of testifying and personalizing our essential nature in more and more places of our life. And I think ultimately, and most the greatest challenge for us as Zen students and practitioners of the Buddha Dharma, is to encounter the imperative itself, the emotional imperative, the impulse of necessity. And rather than blaming it on someone else and saying, if you do that one more time, I will da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da fill in the blanks, but to face it as the imperative to enter into that great fire, that great fire, and to know that the entry to the fire of the Dharmakaya body is a the entry price, of course, is that it is unconditional. And that's both a great, great blessing and quite a difficult thing. Thank you.
So I invite you to sit comfortably. We'll go around the room and say our names. I'm David.
George.
Melissa.
Steve.
I'm Fran.
I'm Matt.
I'm Bob.
Ray.
Steve.
Aaron.
Lynn.
Diane.
Deb.
So, invite reactions, questions, observations.
Yeah. I was talking to Diane the other day in an interview about how my son's 9 years old, and sometimes I'll read him stories at night, but he always likes it better if I make up the story instead of reading the story, because there's some kind of magic energy to it. And I love that style of Dharma talk where you do that, where you hit the clear button and do that. That's wonderful. I find it difficult to do that, but the faith in that is really a wonderful thing to see.
Yeah, it's wonderful that we can actually practice this in all kinds of ways, you know, like telling stories to our children, or even encountering someone. I mean, quite a thing to do, encountering someone we know, the possibility of hitting the clear button and actually, wow, what if I just am present to see what's here? And every time a kind of leaping off of some knowing or some rehearsing or who it is, how we want it to go, but some wonderful invitation.
Yeah, that's what Diane said too.
And you know, just to say that we try to keep interviews confidential and private.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Everything was good.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
But I think, too, and I think of difficult encounters with people or people that are, you know, give you the old body cringe, the sense of possibility that you know, that something other than the totally predictable could happen or might happen or at least hold the possibility. Yeah.
I had it happen when I was telemarketing once.
Yeah.
You know, you're there, you know, call the people at work, you know, they're at work, they're not home, so I didn't feel so bad about it. But being able to sit there as someone who's like really, you know, reaming me another asshole, and it sounds like birds chirping, and I could just say the correct response and kind of calm them down a little bit and make the sale. But, you know, you can have, like, it's wonderful to have, you know, an experience like that when you don't expect some kind of experience like that to happen, mm-hmm. where Dharma manifests like that.
Yeah. Thanks.
And so after these many days that we've been here on this Angha, I do sometimes wonder if I'm dreaming or awake. And when you told the story about the checkout, this happened to me yesterday. I went to go buy laundry detergent at the Price Chopper, and there was an older man, quite older, who was bagging. Mm. And he looked, you know, just really tired, you know, worn down. And he asked me if I wanted a bag, and I said, no, I don't need a bag, you know, because my bottle of laundry detergent. And I could tell he was glad he didn't have to put it in the bag, you know. Mm. But then for just like a second, like, because I've been sitting here for all these days, you know, I just like caught his eye, and his eye caught my eye. Mm. And there was this connection, and like a little smile came on his face, and it was like so beautiful. You know,
you so, get a little tickle, huh?
Yeah. And I could just see, you know, that he connected with me too. So it wasn't just me making up something, you know.
Right.
It was so just these, like you say, you know, just these little things that. Just. Weird, is this real or is it, you know?
Yeah. And it's funny too, it catches you oftentimes so by surprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's not announced.
Yeah.
If it were announced, it wouldn't,
yeah. It's not premeditated either, it's just
right.
now, like, right. You know, this happened. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Stephen and Bob.
I think it really points out, you know, what the possibility is too. I mean, I've noticed that, you know, sometimes coming back from a retreat that, you know, my barriers are down or something, you know, and you just have those moments where there's this sudden connection with someone and you can tell that you know, they feel it too. It's
mm-hmm.
it's very strange. You know, okay, so, you know, maybe I'm a little different, you know, than normal, but then how does this other person, you know, catch it and respond to it? And there's suddenly this, you know, this presence between two people that I very rarely experience. And it really, you know, you think, well, wow, you know, couldn't I bring more of that, you know, to my life somehow? You know, it's such a beautiful thing and so fleeting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But
yeah, just along that line of life responding to life, in the days following this tragedy, I was in town, and what you would see is people making contact. And people making eye contact in their cars. And it was like, I mean, instead of traffic being people, you know, it was like kin-hin. I mean, people were like trying to take care with each other and really noticing and really holding the door and looking at each other as they held the door for each other. And it was really touching, and it will pass, it will fade. But that idea that suddenly the preciousness of life and the preciousness of each other was brought home to everybody all at once.
Mm. Yeah.
Like everybody had been on sashimi.
Yeah. Well, and after the lockdown today, our daughter said the lockdown is over now, but they haven't caught the young man they're looking for. But after the lockdown, I can imagine what it's going to be like as everybody goes out and sees anew.
You said, at one point you said there's no time. And you, it was in a string of things.
Uh-huh.
Certainly there's no separation, but then there's no time. And I just wonder, could you... I realize this wasn't planned, so I don't know if you can roll back the tape and remember what you were saying, but I'd love to hear a little more about that.
Oh. I'm sure we all have the experience of timelessness, and also we all have the experience of the weight of time in our lives, of being harried or hurried, or I have only 5 minutes, or I have, or it's I will get, I have an hour to do this, and then I will. And I think, and that's, and I think one of the hallmarks, if we would. We get our mouths washed out with something, soap or something, to say these things in Zen. But I think one of the hallmarks of the Ta of Shikantaza, Ta means, Shikan means, she means to slow, as you know, and Kan means to perceive immediacy. And ta means to touch and be touched by something. It could be anything, like you were describing people meeting. They were they touch and are touched by. Mind is touched and I think one of the if you had to talk about that experience, that it is outside, clearly outside of time. For instance, the experience of the bird song as simply as metaphor for a possibility of meeting, self-meeting self in some uncontrived immediate way, that those experiences in the Zendo have a timeless quality. They don't seem to be in conventional time. They seem to be, as Dogen said, in being time, not in conventional linear time. And there is a timeless quality, an ancient universal quality of touching to experience that's true and immediate because there isn't anything else. I think that quality in Zen practice, we always talk about relative absolute, and usually we lose the foundation or the not knowing or the clear mind, and we meet it with the ongoing rush. But to meet in that way certainly seems to be outside of time. And then, of course, then we go back to our whatever our preoccupation is, or how am I, how was I, how will I be. So I think, for me, timelessness, being free of time, is a great blessing. And that I find in those timeless moments that have no thought, not that anything is wrong with thought, great meaning and beauty. And the meaning is no meaning whatsoever. And there is no time, but it's incredibly beautiful and meaningful for me. So they all seem to be of... does that respond to your...
I think so, yeah. And time is based on separation.
Well,
and you're talking about experiences where there's no separation.
Yeah, then there is no... I don't think there is any... I don't think time exists. I think certainly this activity of life exists that's morphing and shape-shifting. But I don't think... I think time is a fabrication from that perspective. That it just doesn't exist. There's just the activity of Dharma. Of life, it's a verb. You know, we're studying a verb. You know, what is that John Mayer? You know that John Mayer song? I was listening to that. Love ain't a thing. Ain't a noun. It's a verb. Do you know that song? Oh, anyway, but it's an activity that's just morphing and shape shifting continually, but not in some kind of train track. Yeah.
Some moments are just a lot longer than others.
Some, they would say, especially when your knees hurt.
Well, along that line, why don't we have the bell and we'll stand and do 2 minutes.